1 Samuel 2:12 through 3:21. The second talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on November 12, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel. We'll start with the last half of chapter 2. Last week we looked at chapter 1 and the first half of chapter 2 in 1 Samuel. And there we saw the story of Hannah and Elkanah. Hannah was one of two wives married to Elkanah. Hannah was a faithful woman, but she had no children. And the other wife would rub that in and provoke her. And someone last week afterwards suggested that it's possible that they had attached righteousness to those provocations, claiming that the fact that she was barren was indicative of the fact that she was out of the favor of God, and I think that's possible. So Hannah prayed to God and looked to him for vindication of both her and, more importantly, vindication of God, that she appealed to God to show that he is a rescuer of her, of those that look to him for salvation. And she made a vow in which she said that if God would provide her with a son, then she would give that son over to the service of him. And God responded, and she bore a son, and that was Samuel. So Hannah becomes a bright spot in an age that is otherwise faithless. And that's what we see at the beginning of 1 Samuel, is that contrast between the overall darkness in Israel and the few spots of brightness that are there. And we will continue with that contrast in the last half of chapter 2, where we see the high priests of Israel and the fact that they are lawless rebels against God at this time, and God is going to judge them. It focuses on the high priest. Eli is an old man at this time. He has been the high priest. His two sons are acting as high priests since he is so old. And on several occasions we see Eli, on a couple of occasions, we see Eli sitting by the doorposts of the temple. So he's old, he's infirm, he can't see very well, and he is not capable of serving within the temple. So he sits at the door of the temple and is not actively involved. His sons have become the high priests, and they serve primarily in presenting the offerings for the people who come and bring them. And it, according to the law that was given to God, to Moses by God, the priests are set aside for this purpose of service, and God has made provision for them. It is their job to carry out the duties within the temple, to carry out the offerings, to keep the lamps burning, keep the incense burning, keep everything in order. And in exchange for this work that they do on behalf of the people for Israel, they are to receive some things from the people of Israel. They receive, there are various kinds of gifts that the tribes of Israel are supposed to present to the priests. But in particular, when they give offerings, a portion of those, of certain offerings, go to the priest for their food. And the most relevant to this particular passage is the portion that they are given of two different kinds of offerings. Each kind of offering has a different portion of the animal that is to be given to the priest. But there are two kinds of of offerings. Let's see, Leviticus 7, 30 through 34. You don't need to turn there. I'll read this, but this becomes relevant in our passage. I'll read 28 through 34 in Leviticus chapter 7. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, he who offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his offering to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hands are to bring offerings by fire to the Lord. He shall bring the fat with the breast, that the breast may be presented as a wave offering before the Lord. And the priest shall offer up the fat in smoke on the altar, but the breast shall belong to Aaron and his sons. And you shall give the right thigh to the priest as a contribution from the sacrifices of your peace offerings. The one among the sons of Aaron who offers the blood of the peace offerings and the fat, the right thigh shall be given as his, shall be his as his portion. For I have taken the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the contribution from the sons of Israel from the sacrifices of their peace offerings and have given them to Aaron, the priest, and his sons as their due forever from the sons of Israel." So as I understand it, the Israelites, as they give these offerings, are supposed to come to the temple with the tabernacle, with the meat offering. And that is, what is it? Braised over the fire? But that is, the fat portions are seared. And then the meat is taken, and a portion of that is given to the priests, and the rest is then fully cooked and eaten by the family that's bringing the offering. So that's apparently the procedure that is used. And what we're going to find out in this section is the high priest began to take portions of the meat offerings that they were not supposed to be taking. Chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, starting with verse 12. "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord and the custom of the priests with the people. When any man was offering a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, 'Give the priest meat for roasting, as he will not take boiled meat from you, only raw.' And if the man said to him, 'They must surely burn the fat first, and then take as much as you desire,' then he would say, 'No, but you shall give it to me now, and if not, I will take it by force.' Thus the sin of the young man was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord." So apparently what's happening is people would bring their offerings, and the meat would be seared over the fire, and then they would take the meat and they were boiling it, and when that was happening, a servant of the priest, the high priest, would say to their servants, "Go get us more meat." And the servant would go and stab in the pot, and whatever he pulled out, that was to go to the priest. So the priest is taking a portion that is not allotted to the priests. He's taking more than he is allowed to take by law. The other scenario is they would come with the meat, and before it was even seared over the fire, the priests would say, "Give me a piece of that. I want raw meat. I want to cook it myself. I'm tired of boiled meat. I want raw meat so I can cook it myself." And if they wouldn't provide it, he threatened to take it by force. As a result, then, the narrator, the historian, says, "Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for the men despised the offering of the Lord." It's interesting that this section refers to the sons of Eli as worthless men. When it talked about Hannah in the temple And the priest turned to her when she was in prayer and crying, distraught over the fact that she was being provoked by this other wife because she had no children. The priest thought that she was drunk and reprimanded her for it. And her response was, "I am no worthless woman." And here we have high priests who are worthless men. And it points out that they did not know the Lord. I think what that means is they did not respect God. Their behavior certainly indicate that. And I think that that's what's intended here. They didn't respect God, and they didn't respect the custom of the priests with the people, that is, the law that had been given to them. In contrast to that, we have Samuel, verse 18 through 21. Now Samuel was ministering before the Lord as a boy wearing a linen ephod, and his mother would make him a little robe and bring it to him from year to year when she would come up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children from this woman in place of the one she dedicated to the Lord." And they went to their own home. And the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and gave birth to 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. So just as Hannah had promised, Samuel is serving in the temple, and he will serve God all of his life. So he is living there and being raised by Eli, apparently. Every year, they continue to come back to sacrifice and give their offerings. And every year when they come, Hannah makes for him a little miniature priest's robe that she brings. And as he grows, it's a new robe every year. And he wears those as he serves in the temple. And they come faithfully every year and offer up their offerings. So they continue to do what they had done before. Eli, in response to this, blesses them. Once again, you remember he had blessed them earlier, and the result was Samuel was born to Hannah. Well, now he blesses them again, and Hannah has a total of, I don't know if it's a total of 5 children or if it's 5 more children. It's not clear. But in any case, she has a number of children. Samuel is not her only child. So God has been very gracious to her that he gave her the child Samuel. She carried out her vow, but now God has come through and provided her with more children. So she has been truly blessed. And then it says, and the boy Samuel grew before the Lord. And we'll see that Samuel continues to grow up, mature, and begin to develop the character and grow in righteousness as time goes on. It becomes very significant. Back to the sons now. In the narrative, we'll be going back and forth between Samuel and the sons. 22 through 26. Now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, "Why do you do such things, the evil things that I hear from all these people? No, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Now the boy Samuel was growing in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men. Eli's old, as we've talked about before, but he has heard reports of what's going on inside the tabernacle and what his sons are doing. And here, and he has multiple sources. It's not just one or two people saying this. He's hearing repeatedly reports of what his sons have been doing. And here, if The last half of verse 22 is in the Masoretic text. That is, it's in what is considered to be the most reliable version of the Hebrew text. But it is not in the Septuagint, that is, the translation of the Hebrew text into Greek that was done about 200 or 300 B.C. So I don't know whether this is a part of the original text or not. But if it is, it's very curious. Because it points out that in addition to their offenses with respect to the offerings, it says that they lay with the women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So in addition to their offenses with respect to the offerings, they've been sleeping around with the women who serve inside the tabernacle. And if that's the case, that's particularly curious, because in some ways this is the more outrageous, it seems like, of the offenses. But it's the other one that has been highlighted up to now. That their sin is more a sin against God than it is against other men. And that's the emphasis. Eli tries to correct them. He tries to convince them that what they're doing is evil and they should not do it. And he uses a line of argument that is interesting. He says, if one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? If I offend someone else, God can be the one who reconciles us. He can enter into that and reconcile us, work things out. But what Eli is saying is, what if you offend the judge? If you offend the judge, there's no one to turn to who can mediate. You have offended the only one who can mediate. So what he's underscoring here is these sins are offenses against God. They aren't offenses against other people. That's what is so grievous. But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Apparently God has hardened their hearts such that they are not responsive to what Eli has been saying to them, and they continue in their behavior. Then in contrast to that, Samuel is growing in stature and in favor both with the Lord and with men. And that's kind of the constant refrain that we see through here. On the one hand, we see the wickedness of the established priesthood in Israel. And I think that's indicative of wickedness throughout Israel. But we have this little spark of brightness. There's some light here, and that's this son Samuel who's growing up and finding favor with God. The next section, 27 through 36. Then a man of God came to Eli and said to him, thus says the Lord, did I not indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt in bondage to Pharaoh's house? And did I not choose them from all the tribes of Israel to be my priests, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to carry an ephod before me? And did I not give to the house of your father all the fire offerings of the sons of Israel? Why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering, which I commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel? Therefore the Lord God of Israel declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me. For those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. And you will see the distress of my dwelling, in spite of all that I do good for Israel. And an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will not cut off every man of yours from my altar, that your eyes may fail from weeping, and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life. And this will be the sign to you which shall come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day both of them shall die. But I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. And it shall come about that everyone who is left in your house shall come and bow down to him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread and say, please assign me to one of the priest's offices so that I may eat a piece of bread. So a prophet comes to Eli, and a prophet gives a prophecy with respect to Eli and his descendants. And he begins by making an argument, appealing to Eli and saying, first of all, I revealed myself to your ancestors. And I think in particular it's speaking of the descendants of Levi through Aaron. So it's the descendants of Aaron in particular that he seems to be talking about. So he's saying, I came to your ancestors. I came to the descendants, to Aaron and his descendants. And this happened a long time ago. This happened about 250 years earlier. And I singled them out from all the 12 tribes. I singled out the tribe of Levi, and from the tribe of Levi, I singled out the clan of Aaron and his descendants. And I gave them very special tasks to do, important services to perform on my behalf. That is, to serve in the temple, to serve as mediators between God and man. And in exchange for that service, I guaranteed your livelihood. That is, I made provision for you to be cared for, that you were to receive a portion of what was offered. Given that history, given what I've done, why is it that you have come to disdain the offerings that I have asked the people of Israel to present? And take the best for yourselves rather than leaving the best for me, rather than seeing it as a gift to me. He points out that he had made a promise earlier that Aaron's family, his descendants, would serve as priests in the house of God forever. And he's holding to that promise. He's not altering that promise. But he says, far be it from me to make this a license for abuse, a license for license. He says, I will honor those who honor me, but those who despise me, I will lightly esteem. So it's a warning that just because one is a priest doesn't put them out of bounds of being punished by God and falling into dishonor. And then he says, the way that you will know, I'm going to give you a sign. Oh, and what will happen is he is going to weaken the house of Eli. No one in Eli's family from here on out will live to old age. That's the first part of it. But there will always be descendants of Eli, and those descendants will be there to see the decline of the temple. They will be there to weep and mourn over the decline of the temple in later years. And as a sign that all of this will come about, he says, on the same day, both of your sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall die. That is a sign that these other things will come to pass. Then he ends it with a very interesting section. I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul. And I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. This is interesting. In the prayer of Hannah, Hannah hints at an eternal kingdom, a king that God will give his strength to. It says that God will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king, and will exalt the horn of his anointed. So it gives promise of this kingdom in which God is the judge. Here it's giving hint of a priest who will be truly faithful and who will walk before my anointed always. So earlier we had this hint of a kingdom, and now we have this hint of an eternal priest who will be faithful to God. And it is also prophesied that everyone who descends from Eli as priests, they are going to be destitute. And they will beg for a position of service in the temple that will allow them to receive income to live on. He says, and it shall come about that everyone who is left in your house shall come and bow down to him, that is this faithful priest, for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and say, please assign me to one of the priest's offices so that I may get a piece of bread. So the offense has been that they were taking that which was not for them to take. And in the future, then, the descendants of Levi will be scrounging for food and begging for a position to serve in the temple so that they can receive at least something to eat. Now, this faithful priest, I'm not sure whether what's intended here is a person or a line of descent. During the time of David, there will be a priest, Zadok, who who becomes the high priest and is one who is characterized as being faithful. And then it's his descendants that become the high priest for a long period of time. And I don't know whether that line continues down to the time of Jesus or not. So it could be that it's talking about that line of descent, or it could be talking more specifically about Christ to come, that Christ would be that faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul. The only thing that's troubling about that is to put it together with him walking before my anointed always, because the anointed is the king, which is also Jesus. But it could be that both the priest and the king are Jesus, and that this language is appropriate for that reality. Okay, now God appears to Samuel, and God is going to appear to Samuel and say some things that confirm this which has been prophesied to Eli through this prophet. First half of chapter 3. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. And it happened at that time, as Eli was lying down in his place, now his eyesight had begun to grow dim, and he could not see well. And the lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was, that the Lord called Samuel, and he said, here I am. Then he ran to Eli and said, here I am, for you called me. But he said, I did not call, lie down again. So he went and lay down. And the Lord called yet again, Samuel. So Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, here I am, for you called me. But he answered, I did not call, my son, lie down again. Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him. So the Lord called Samuel again for the third time. And he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. And Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and it shall be if he calls you that you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. So Samuel is, it's at night. It is before the lamp has gone out. And as I understand it, there is a lamp that they would fill with oil in the evening before they went to bed and just let it burn until the oil was all gone. And then in the morning they would refill that. And the next evening they would light that again. So this is not in the this is in the first half or three quarters of the night rather than in the latter part of the night that this event happens. Eli is sleeping in another room of the house. And this is where the Ark of the Covenant is being kept. Samuel is sleeping in the room where the Ark of the Covenant is, the Ark of the Covenant being the most holy object in Israel at this time. And so they're in separate rooms. Eli has been explained before as getting old, and his eyes are getting dim. It's an interesting comment for the author to throw in here. And it could be that the point of this comment is to say that Eli was frequently in need of assistance. So Samuel was used to being called to come and help Eli. So that is possible, and I'm sure that is the case. But I suspect there's another reason for including this, because the dimness of his eyesight, I think, is metaphoric of the dimness of the eyesight in Israel in general. And in fact, this dim lamp lighting the room in which the Ark of the Covenant is stored is probably also metaphoric of that same thing. It is quite dark, but there's still a little bit of light. And that's what the first part of this book seems to be about. It says that the word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. This seems to go along with Jack's comments a couple weeks ago when he was saying that there seems to be differences in the frequency of God's overt activity here on earth. That there are times when he is very overtly active and doing lots of things that are visible for all to see. And there are other times when he pulls back and he is, for all intents and purposes, quiet. He's not overtly active in the world. In this case, God has not been overtly active, and visions were infrequent. So, Samuel is in this other room. And by the way, apparently, remember when the Israelites were going through the desert, God gave the law to Moses, gave them instructions for the construction of this tabernacle, this portable temple that they were to take with them. And that's where the priests served. When they made their way finally into the promised land, that tabernacle was taken to, it's thought that it first went to Gilgal, and then it was moved to Shiloh, and that's where it is when the events here take place. And that originally that temple was very portable. The walls around the curtain, around the outside that demarcated the temple from everything else, they were just fabric and skins. And because it had to be carried, it had to be portable. But once they located in Shiloh, apparently buildings were built around the perimeter of this, And those replaced the screens that had been there before. And it's in these houses that form the perimeter of this temple area that the priests and their helpers lived. And so they're apparently in houses when these events take place. Samuel hears a call in the night. He thinks it's Eli. He runs in and says, "Eli, can I help?" Eli says, "I didn't call." He goes back to bed. He hears it again. He goes running in. He says, "Eli, what would you like me to do?" Eli says, "I didn't call you." He goes back. That happens three times. And then Eli, and it says, verse 7, "Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him." Now I think this is the same wording that was used with respect to the high priest when it said that they did not know the Lord. But I think this is in a different sense. That here, Samuel does not yet know the Lord in the sense that he doesn't recognize his voice. That has been God calling, but he did not recognize it as such. Which is very interesting to think that you have to learn to recognize God's voice. There are other times when, on the first occasion, when people hear it, it's obviously God speaking. But in this case, apparently it's not as obvious. So Eli thinks about what's happened, and you have to give him a break. This is in the middle of the night. It finally occurs to him, "Oh, I know what's going on. That is God speaking." So he sends it back and says, "Next time, respond to God himself." And that's what happens. Verse 10. "Then the Lord came and stood and called, as at other times, 'Samuel, Samuel.' And Samuel said, 'Speak, for thy servant is listening.' And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. And therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever.'" So God calls out to Samuel again. And Samuel responds, "I'm here, speak." And then God says to Samuel, "I'm going to do something shocking." He doesn't say what that shocking thing is. We see what the shocking thing is in the next chapter. And that shocking thing is the Philistines are going to capture the Ark of the Covenant and take it away. But he says, I am about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. It's going to be a truly shocking thing that will take place. And in that day, he's going to carry out what he had told Eli would happen through the prophet. It says, "I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end." And then he gives the justification for it. It's because for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. So it's for his sons and their wickedness, and the fact that Eli did not rebuke them for that. And as a result, the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. That's awfully grim. And it's ironic that it is the sons of Eli that were giving the sacrifices and offerings to God for on behalf of other people. And yet, there will be no sacrifice or offering that will bring atonement for them. because of what they've done. So Samuel lay down until morning, then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. But Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. Then Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "What is the word that he spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also, if you hide anything from me of all the words that he spoke to you." So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." So Samuel hears this from God, goes back to sleep, wakes up the next morning, and he doesn't want to tell Eli what he heard. It's not good news, and he doesn't want to pass that on. So he doesn't say anything. And I suspect that Eli knows that it's got to be bad news. If it had been good news, Samuel would have told him. And he knows Samuel. God told Samuel something. So he says, "You got to tell me. And if you don't tell me, may the same thing happen to you and worse." So he knows it's a bad thing that God has told him. And he probably suspects that it's confirmation of what the prophet had told him earlier. And it is. So Samuel tells him everything that God had told him, relates it to him faithfully. And Eli's response is, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." He is resigned to it. But I think it's more than just being resigned to it. I think he realizes that this is good and proper, that God knows best, and it's good and proper what he chooses to do here. Bitter for him personally, Eli, but good and proper. Then finally, the last three verses of chapter 3. Thus Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his Lord's words fail. And all Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. So in contrast to Eli and his sons, here we have someone who has been raised up to be a faithful representative of God to the people. This is that little spark of light, I think, that's still burning. Okay, there are a couple of things that I want to talk about in this section. Both of them sobering. The first is, who is to blame for the son's wrongdoing? We have Phinehas and Hophni, who are doing outrageous things in the temple. They are high priests, and yet they're doing outrageous things in the temple. And it points out that Eli spoke to them. He rebukes them and tells them that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing. But they don't listen to him because, it says, for the Lord desired to put them to the death. So apparently this is another situation in which God has hardened their hearts. We've seen that occurred with respect to Pharaoh. We see that other places where God hardens someone's heart such that they are resistant to listening to the truth. And that is because God has purposes that he wants to carry out that involve that person being rebellious against him. This is an issue that gets talked about a lot in this church, and I'm not going to pursue it any further at this point. But that is a tough reality that we see from time to time in the scriptures, that the sons are responsible for their wickedness, but their hearts are hardened by God, such that they are rebellious. But what is Eli's responsibility in this? As a parent, I find this kind of passage both sobering and disturbing. Eli is held responsible for their misbehavior as well as them. It's possible that what is told to Eli and his sons is largely because they're priests. And so it is in his capacity as priest that he's being reprimanded by God rather than in his capacity as parent. But I suspect that it is at least partially also in his capacity as a parent. There's no indication that he was complicit in what they had done. He isn't sending out servants to spear some meat for him. It's his sons that are doing that. There's no indication that he was approving of that behavior. And we do have a record of him trying to correct them. But it was ineffective. Is it for that that he is being, and his offspring are being punished as well? I don't know. Maybe it's because of earlier parenting that was deficient that has led to this point for which he is being punished. I don't know. This, my perspective on life is that life is murky. And as a parent, dealing with your children is particularly murky. It's hard to know how one ought to parent wisely and faithfully. I think all that we can do is to act as wisely and faithfully as we can and to trust God with the outcome. And there's a sense in which Eli's response is an admirable one when he says, "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." That ultimately, God is the one that's in control, and he knows what's best, and he loves us, and he will do that which is in our best interest. And we have to allow him to do that. And we have to allow him to do that even in the lives of our children. And that's a difficult point to come to, but I think it's a point that we have to come to. God is going to do what he is going to do, and our children are going to become their own persons. And we have our input into their lives throughout their lives, and we ought to make the best of that opportunity. But ultimately, everything is in God's hands, and less ultimately, our children are going to make their own choices. The other thing that I want to talk about in this section is the behavior of the high priest. Yet there is something particularly despicable about the high priest behaving the way that they did with respect to the sacrifices and the offerings. If anyone should take the sacrifices and offerings seriously, it should be the high priest. If they don't, then it's going to devalue those things in the eyes of everyone. Now, that's not necessarily the case. It is possible for people to realize that the priests are, how the priests act with respect to the offerings and sacrifices is separate from the attitude that the faithful ought to have towards those same sacrifices and offerings. And we have an example of that. Elkanah and Hannah are coming every year and presenting their offerings. And presumably, they have experienced the same kind of behavior that everybody else has experienced. That outrageous behavior on the part of the priests, taking an undue portion of those offerings. Nevertheless, they keep coming back year after year to give those offerings because they understand that they're dealing primarily with God. That's what's important. The offering, the priests are just playing this role of mediator. And if they discount the offerings, that doesn't really matter. The offerings are still important in the eyes of God and the eyes of anyone who's going to be faithful to God. However, to take that perspective is very difficult. That requires a great deal of maturity and wisdom. Generally speaking, we look at those who represent God as people who represent what God is all about. And if someone is in the role of a priest, they ought to represent what God values. They ought to value what God values. And if they don't, then it's hard to take God and his values seriously. And I think it's because of their capacity as high priest that God judged them so severely. This is a big deal. This is not just a little deal. In our time, the same thing could be said with respect to teachers. We don't have priests, but we do have people who, to one degree or another, represent God and what he has to say. And that's those who teach. As I stand here, there's a sense in which I represent God. And James wrote, in James 3:1, he said, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we shall incur a stricter judgment. That it is good and proper for those that represent God to be held to a higher standard because they ought to value the things that God values if they're going to teach the things that God values." I think it's that reality that is what makes the recent news report so disturbing. I had never heard of Ted Haggard before the recent events, so I don't know anything more about him than what I read in the papers. But if the reports are true, it is a travesty. I mean, it is outrageous that someone who would represent God, be a teacher of the Bible, would act in a way that is so much in opposition to the things that he is teaching. And I think that there, for such people, there is a strict judgment that is coming. Clearly, teachers will not be perfect. That's not what's in view here. Life is a struggle for everyone. Life is a struggle for teachers included. But of all people, those who teach and represent God have an obligation to embrace God's values and to be intent on doing that which is good and true. And it is truly sad when those who teach the Word of God act in a way that brings discredit to the Bible and to what God stands for. And that has happened all too often in our culture in recent times. Comments? Questions?
The wording in here is a little strange about the rebuke. Mm-hmm. Eli's rebuked for not rebuking, but yet he did rebuke.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if it obviously takes more than just a verbal confrontation in this situation to be considered a rebuke. And I'm wondering if the problem that Eli had was that he had the power and authority to stop what his sons were doing by removing them or somehow forcing the issue and just chose not to do it. Is that?
I think that's possible. It's hard to reconstruct. We don't have much to go on, but we do have record of Eli rebuking them in a sense, and yet, as you point out, he's being reprimanded for not rebuking them. So whatever he did doesn't constitute a real rebuke. And the question is, to my mind, is there something that he should have done? Should he have taken stronger measures, for instance, remove them from the high priest, from their positions as high priest? Maybe that's the case, that maybe he should have done something more significant. The other possibility is maybe what he did was too little too late, that maybe there's a whole pattern of when Eli was younger and probably more capable of standing up to his sons, that he didn't do so. And I don't know which is the case, but I think it's clear from the record here that what he did was inadequate. There should have, in some sense, there should have been something more that he had done.
That answered my first question. The other thing I was curious about is the curse that's brought on Eli's lineage. Do you think that the statement about there's no sacrifice or offering that will make atonement is in the context of the kinds of sacrifices and offerings they were making, the nature of those, and how they could possibly be extended? Or would that include also the work of Christ?
Well, I'm inclined to think that what's in view here is that for one who sins against God, for one who is adamantly saying to God, go to hell, for such a person there is no atonement. I mean, that is the sin for which people will be punished eternally. And I think that's what's in view.
Oh, that makes sense to me. I'm just thinking it sounded like it was extended to future generations forever.
Well,
but I wasn't clear on that, I guess.
It says, and therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. So what is the iniquity of Eli's house? Let me think about that. I'm not sure.
Okay, and I'm inclined to think that you were right the way you answered it initially, but I was just curious.
Let me think about that.
Okay, thanks.
I was curious, related to Terry's question, are the sins that Eli's sons did, there were several sins that were punishable by death, and it seems like things like adultery and rape were included in those. It seems like it might be possible that the things that Eli's sons were doing ought to have been punished by death.
Well, there's no indication that there's rape, but there is...
Yeah, right.
There apparently is sex out of wedlock happening. And that, I hadn't thought of that, but that is interesting. And it could be that is at least in part what Eli is responsible for, is that he didn't carry out that which was required by law.
The other thing that I was thinking about, and I don't quite know what could be drawn from it, but it seems interesting to me that when God calls to Samuel, I mean, he isn't really explicit. He doesn't say, like, Samuel, it's God. You know, don't run to
yeah.
Eli.
Yeah. Yeah.
He just lets Samuel, he waits. I don't know what to make of it.
But doesn't that seem very God-like? I mean, the murkiness of life is partially a result of God not being all that overt sometimes. It seems to me that's very in keeping.
I'm confused why Samuel gets to serve as a Levite when it says that his father was an Ephraimite.
Let's see. I remember seeing in a commentary an explanation of that, but I can't remember what the explanation was. I'll have to look at that. Because I think that he's actually of the priestly line, but is living in the area of the tribe of Ephraim, and there is precedent for people, Levites, living in wherever they live, being called by that tribal name. So I think that's the case with Samuel, but I'm not positive. I'll have to look at that.
It seems like there's this huge contrast between the way that God responds to Eli and his sons in terms of the judgment and the way that Eli responded to his sons personally.
Okay.
So I was thinking that would go to what you were saying about to Terry's question, how you answered Terry's question with respect to some, there was something about the way that Eli responded to his sons that was inadequate mm-hmm. to the problem. Because mm-hmm. it's just yeah. huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that could very well be that what we're seeing here and what we're supposed to understand is that Eli's response doesn't take seriously the seriousness of the crimes that are being committed. I mean, the crimes that are being committed are truly outrageous. I mean, it is incredible.
Eli raised kind of two groups of children, his two birth sons, and then he also raised Samuel. Mm-hmm. And so in one sense you could say, well, he did it wrong and he did it right, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. But isn't the emphasis more on kind of how God created the disposition of the children themselves, in that, you know, his two actual sons kind of responded, kind of had a heart against God, and Sammy had a heart for God?
Certainly. Any parent realizes that when a child is born to you, there's a lot there that's completely out of your control, either for good or for bad. I mean, they are their person. And as a parent, all we do is play this role, a limited role, of channeling that and shaping that and that sort of thing. So that's certainly true. There's no question about it.
I'm kind of working with bringing this into these days a little bit, and I wonder if you could comment on, you made the distinction between the priesthood and the father role. And that's one distinction. I wonder if you could also make a distinction between what we talked about earlier about how God operates in different times. And I guess what I'm thinking of in particular is you hear a lot these days about the sins of the fathers being visited on generations, and we can interpret that all kinds of ways these days as, you know, people who grow up and have a lot of trouble in their lives. And how do we look at that, and is there any connection at all? Is there any way to, I mean, I think I know what I'm kind of going toward on that, but I wonder if you could comment on, does God still work the same way, and how would we know if he did? Do you know what I mean?
I don't quite understand your question, so why don't you tell us where you're going on that, and then I'll...
Okay. That's murky.
Well, I'll match you murk for murk.
Okay. I guess I'm thinking about, I've heard people say that, or wonder about the lineage of a particular kind of sin besetting a particular family. For example, alcoholism, or, you know, there's a lot of different examples of that. And I've heard some people interpret that as God's judgment on a particular forefather. And I wonder, that seems kind of like, we're not hearing that directly from God, for one thing. And so I'm not as inclined to go with that interpretation of current events. But I wondered, that's what I wanted to see if you could speak to that a little bit. Does that make more sense?
This is a different situation in which God has explicitly said that there's going to be a judgment on the house of Eli. And that's very different from in our time when you have a family that goes bad. How is that a judgment of God? There's a sense in which it probably is a judgment from God, but it's not like this, because you can't put your finger on exactly what is the judgment and what is that judgment for. Having said that, however, it seems to me pretty clear that families develop patterns of behavior that are passed on, and those can be either good or bad. And you can have a family that will develop patterns of behavior that are rooted in sin, and those are going to have an impact on the children born in that family, and the children of those children, and the children of those children. That we need to take seriously the fact that my behavior as a parent is going to be echoed for a long time in my descendants. That's just the way it is, for good or for bad.
I have a question about verse 7. I'm interested in that. How old was Samuel during this time, and is that verse applying simply to the special role that Samuel was going to have, the word of the Lord not yet revealed to him, or is this some kind of a window into God's perspective on children and his relationship? Does that make sense?
Well, let me try to answer, and then we'll see if I got it. We don't know how old he was. When he is first turned over, it's when he's weaned, and it says he was very small, very young. So, and the traditional age of weaning, as far as we can tell at this time, was at about 3. So he's probably 3 or 4 when he goes to the temple, which is very young for Eli, who's very old to be taken care of. I think that's interesting. And we don't know how much time passes between that event and this event. But there are indications that there's probably several years that have gone by. So my guess is that he's in his late teens, but I'm just guessing. That he did not yet know the Lord. The way I'm taking that is he hasn't had experience with hearing the voice of God before. So I'm interpreting it to be different here than it was with respect to Hophni and Phinehas, who, when it said they did not know the Lord, I think there it meant they didn't respect God. Nor had the word of the Lord yet been revealed to him, that he had not received any prophecies yet, I think is what is in view there. Later on, he does receive prophecies. He becomes a judge of Israel and a highly respected one. So I think he frequently is spoken to by God. I think that's what we're to understand.
Well, this isn't a situation where we can get a sense of the age of accountability of kids or anything like that.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And even if we could, we don't know what that is. There might be one, but we don't know when that is.
I have several things here. I want you to do some homework.
Mm-hmm. Great. Who's the teacher here?
Yeah. Is it possible? I can't find it here. Is it possible that you could translate? There we go. Verse 35. I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before me, understood as my anointed always, so that he is both the anointed and the priest. That mm-hmm. that would be interesting to me. I didn't quite understand what God is saying to them about the Aaronic priesthood here. And maybe you could clarify that. I mean, it's not obvious to me from our English translation that he is, in fact, whether he is or is not forsaking them. And if he is forsaking them, or if he's not forsaking them, I guess I should say, could it be that what he's saying is, I promised you that you would have the rightful place and role to be priests under the Mosaic covenant in perpetuity for all time, but that because you have not, you know, because of your disobedience, you're not going to function in that role. But he's not giving the role to anybody else. That is, that still belongs to them. It's just that he's going to bypass them and won't be using them at all. And then I wondered if that was related to that, the end where he says, and the Lord appeared again at Shiloh. Any indication that you have the Shekinah glory coming and going at Shiloh, depending upon how the priests are doing? I mean, could that be what he means? And then finally...
Well, let me
okay.
respond to that briefly. My take on this section at the end of chapter 2 is that he is not removing from the house of Aaron the priesthood. But I think what he's saying is, he says, I did indeed say to your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. That was to Aaron and his descendants. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. I think there he's speaking specifically to Eli's household. And saying, since you have been a house that has not honored me, then this will happen to your house, but I'm not revoking the promise that I made to the house of Aaron.
Okay, so that makes sense. So he's just saying that that's no protection for you as an individual within that line.
Right.
That just
that doesn't guarantee that everybody who's a descendant of Aaron will always serve in that capacity.
Okay. And then just on a more general note, what strikes me about this passage, and I don't know how to take that comment by Eli, if it is the Lord, let him do what he seems good to him. That could be an incredibly righteous response, depending upon
right.
how you take that. What strikes me is when he goes to rebuke them, and it says that the Lord, basically, as you interpreted, has hardened their hearts, and that sounds right to me, that what it illustrates for me is the importance of recognizing that we don't own our children, that the children are not ours to determine their destiny. And I think it just is commonplace in our Christian culture in this country today to begin to think as young parents that if I just do this thing right, I'm going to end up with godly, obedient, righteous children. And I think that's a fallacy. If the Lord is doing what the Lord is doing, and he could take the children of godly parents, of utterly godly parents, and make them completely reprobate people, and in the end, we just have to come to terms with that. I mean, it's really hard, because every instinct in us is to protect our children, and the ultimate protection is to protect them all the way to eternal life. But as hard as that is, it seems to me that part of my bowing my knee to God ends up being, Lord, my children belong to you. They're your creation, and you will do with them what you will do with them, and you don't owe me anything.
I'm inclined to think that that's what the passage is doing. The only problem there is that he does rebuke Eli because he says that Eli did not rebuke them in 3:13. So there's something that Eli has done that was not proper. It may not have changed anything.
Right. I think that's my point, is that I think we have the perspective that if I had just given the right rebuke, everything would have been different. But I think the text tells us otherwise. God may have a problem with him for not having given them the right rebuke, but it's not because the outcome was what it was, because God had ordained the outcome.
I'm inclined to think that it is that Eli grew up and became wiser as time went on, and that that's what makes it possible for him to be a good parent to Samuel. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but that could be the case. And that it's a pattern of behavior that he established early. He did not check his sons at an earlier age. That's in mind here. I think we need to quit there. Thanks.